I'm Jim Delaney. I was working for the Enquirer the night of the fire. I was assistant city editor. Over the time that the Beverly Hills fire permeated the news, I had several jobs, including assistant city editor, and then I was the investigative reporter, city editor, and metro editor. So I had a variety of jobs over the time that really the Beverly Hills Supper Club fire dominated the news for many, many years.
Let's start from the beginning. First question, had you been there, you and your wife? Have been
I had not. I had not, but everybody knew about it, and I had been painting all day. It was a beautiful day, and I ran up to a convenience store to get something that I think I was going to grill out or something. I needed something. And I got to what was then a King Quick store. And luckily, I was not covered with paint, but I had already showered. And I get into this convenience store, and all these people are gathered around the radio. And I said, what's going on? And they said, 50 people are dead at Beverly Hills. And I said, oh, my. And there was days before cell phones, of course. I grabbed the payphone in there and called my wife and said, I'm going to the office. When I arrived at the office, Denny Doherty was assistant city editor in charge, and he had already emptied the newsroom to get over there. And as I suspected, what he needed was somebody who could be what we call the rewrite man. And somebody had started that, but it might have been an intern. I don't even remember who it was. But I jumped in and took over that task really for the rest of the night. And while I was not on the scene, it was an incredible night at the Enquirer for many reasons. As you'll remember, the circulation of the Enquirer was, by today's standards, astronomical, especially on a Sunday. And I think the circulation on a Sunday was over 300,000 at that time. And I was one of the earlier ones to arrive, and everything was at 617 Vine Street then. But as the news spread, everybody who worked in the newsroom was pouring into the newsroom, and they were stopping the press to update the stories. That's we call them makeovers. That went on for hours, you know, well into the wee hours of the night.
And there was also a bit of confusion because the Duro Bag Company in Covington also went up in flames that night. There was two major fires by fire standards, but not any casualties.
It did. And I remember trying to sort that out and then realizing that we don't think there's any injuries there. The story I was writing would just concentrate on the Beverly Hills fire. And everything was by phone. Again, no cell phones. So some by two-way radio and some by telephone. And as the reporters were phoning it in to me or whoever, you would make sense of it and keep updating the edition.
Covering that fire today with today's technology would be totally different.
Absolutely.
Because you'd have a cell phone, you could take video, you could stream video, you could take pictures, you could call anybody, not just into the desk, but anybody you needed to.
And everyone, not just the journalist, but the public would be watching it, either online or on Facebook, or they would be watching it somehow. So it'd almost be like having to write the color at a baseball game because everybody knew the facts. Everybody would have known the facts or at least knew what they could see. And, of course, at that time, there was a lot that people could see, but still relying on information the good old-fashioned way.
And the difference from then and today is that if I was there with my wife or somebody, that I could come out, I could text my family and let them know it's okay. There's plenty of people who knew people who were going to go to the Beverly Hills that they just didn't know till the next
four
day.
Hours. Yeah. Hours and hours. I do remember commotion. I remember Luke Feck, then the editor. And so I was back. You'll remember where the city desk part of it was. And that was that was one of the hubs in the newsroom. But the other was the news desk where page one was done. And I can't remember who was the acting news editor that night. But I do remember that very quickly, Luke Feck, the editor, was there. And while my job was to get the facts and to keep that story updated, there was almost a commotion as they were picking the photographs that were going to go onto one of the makeovers, and they were Jerry Walters' photographs. And the reason there was a commotion was, I think Luke had made the decision that the picture would show dead bodies, really people in their finery, if you will, laying on the grass.
That was the front page photo, the bodies laying horizontally in the front and then the building on top in flames.
It was an unbelievable news photo, but also a very, very controversial call to do that because it was like nothing that this town had ever seen.
Well, I want to skip forward a bit because then there was a couple of different investigations, and I was looking at the book that was put out by the National Fire Prevention and Control Administration. They said the findings were reasons of the fire, combustible materials in a concealed space where it burned for a while. The Beverly Hills staff attempted to put out the fire, before they called the fire department, the delay in calling the fire department. The cabaret room had more than twice as many people and not enough exits, and that some of the exterior finishes in the hallways accelerated how the flames went up and down the halls, and they said no sprinkler. In that report, there was no mention of aluminum wiring, but very quickly on, aluminum wiring became an issue, and it caught the attention of Stan Chesley. Is that correct?
What happened was Chesley and his team had heard reports that they were just going to take bulldozers and plow it down. And he went into federal court, and he said, we need evidence, we need evidence. I mean, literally, there were people there that tried to throw him off the property. They had federal marshals and said no. One of the people that he brought with him was an electrician. I think his name was Jim Amond. And he found aluminum wiring that first day. And Chesley later admitted he didn't know that that was significant. He had no idea that was significant. But what the electrician was saying is it's hard to believe that anybody ever looked at any of this. And so it wasn't a secret that the fire was believed to be electrical in nature. It's still controversial. Some people still say that, you know, that it couldn't have been an aluminum wiring. But the other code violation that came out in the course of all the litigation was not one of the first to be mentioned, not the overcrowding, not the lack of exits, but the use of aluminum wiring was never permitted in a commercial building, okay? There are a lot of hoops they had to jump through to make their aluminum wiring theory. But in terms of a violation of the law, it was not under whether old technology, new technology, it just wasn't permitted in a commercial building. And the chain of evidence suggests that it was there, that first, within 2 weeks of the fire, when they went there under a federal court protective order to say they could examine evidence, that's when it was found.
This was one of the first big class action suits.
It was. The chronology is not, I'm not real clear on the whole chronology. He settled with the Schillings. The Schilling family, the owners of the club, he settled with them for a relatively low amount of money. And in the thinking in the legal community was there would never come much of this litigation because you had what became 165 deaths. For years it was reported 164. And then somebody died 9 months later, I think. But you multiply that into $3 or $4 million, it was nothing. But Chesley had these theories of law. And so the family, that was the first. And then the second was, it was really CG&E, the name of the utility prior to Duke, but really it was CG&E's Union Light, Heat, and Power, which was a wholly owned subsidiary of CG&E. One of the things that Chesley and his team found out pretty quickly is that the utility had a duty to inspect. So if there was any new add-on or anything like that, and bear in mind the state police report, the report commissioned by Governor Julian Carroll, had declared it an electrician's nightmare. And so Chesley's first theory was it was somewhere established that to get power on, there was a duty to inspect on the part of the utility company. And that became one of his early successes. I think he settled that in the neighborhood of $5 to $6 million as he was beginning to develop these other theories, okay? And that then people could see, oh, yeah, there could be a major fund for the victims of this fire, which is the way it ultimately turned out.
And then there was actually a federal trial before Judge Rubin about 1980 or so?
Yes. Actually, the settlement with Union Light, Heat, and Power was in 1979 for about $6.7 million. And then next, it was in late 1979, this months-long trial began. And Judge Rubin was a federal judge assigned to the Southern District of Ohio. But there was no federal judge assigned to Covington. As a matter of fact, there was a judge assigned to another Kentucky city who had issued that order to allow Chesley onto the property. But Rubin volunteered for the case, and so he sat by designation, and the trial was held at the old federal building on Scott Street in Covington. The Enquirer had enough people in those days that I was assigned to cover it, as was a reporter from the Kentucky office, Bob Fogarty, and Bob and I covered that for months on end. That led to a very interesting situation at the end of the trial. We had planned, of course, to, once the trial was over, we wanted to know what the jurors thought. And while you knew you couldn't talk to a juror during the trial, it was considered the jurors were fair game to the media after the trial. You know, if they declined comment, you respected that and moved on to the next. But, you know, that was something that, and so we were we had our plan on how we were going to interview those jurors staked out. And I was in the first floor. It was a first floor courtroom. And I was outside right near the main entrance trying to get to a juror as they were let go. And who walks out but Judge Rubin? Well, I'd known Judge Rubin for many years. He was feared by attorneys in this town, just feared by attorneys. But he had a pretty good reputation with the media. I had previously worked at Channel 9, and he used to be a panelist on a show that Channel 9 had called Impact. And so he knew who I was. I knew who he was. But he looked at me like I was a young attorney and said, "You cannot interview that juror. I am ordering you. That's an order of this court. You can't do that." I didn't know what to do then.
This would have been after a verdict in that case?
There was a verdict. After all this trial, the jury came back, and Judge Rubin, this is his word, not mine, but he had bifurcated the issues in the trial. So this creative split in two, the first question was there aluminum wiring at the Beverly Hills Supper Club? Second question, did aluminum wiring in the Beverly Hills Supper Club cause the fire? I don't remember how they answered the first question, but clearly on the second question, they ruled that it did not cause the fire. Chesley had lost his case when I approached this juror. So I never got to ask my question. So I quickly called the office. The Enquirer was then represented by Keating, Muthing, and Kleekamp. We decided that it was an illegal order by the judge, but we would respect the court's ruling, and we would appeal to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is what we did. Then, within about 10 days to 2 weeks, the Sixth Circuit ruled in our favor, and we got the word that I think they vacated his oral ruling, and we were free to interview the jurors.
But in that interim, the Kentucky Post had already interviewed
them. They had. They were there. They didn't happen to be in the line of Judge Rubin and his raft like I was, and so they got some quotes. They weren't really significant, but having taken the trouble to go to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, we felt like we better pull out all the stops and interview all of them. And the next part I did not do, and Bob Fogarty did, but I think he had called this juror, and this juror must have shown up at the Enquirer's Kentucky Bureau with a letter, because it's now established that there was a letter. And what the letter said was that he knew it couldn't have been aluminum wiring because he had aluminum wiring in his house. And he was afraid for his family, so he had checked every aluminum wiring receptacle, which is part of the theory of how the fire starts, that it happens at a junction box or where there's an outlet, a light outlet, or where there's some debris buildup. So Bob, in his low-key way, called me over in Cincinnati and said, "Jim, do you think we got anything here?" I said, "Yes, I think we do." And, of course, it led the Enquirer the next day. And it took a while for the Sixth Circuit to rule on that. It took, you know, maybe a year or so. And while praising Judge Rubin for the way he conducted the trial and some of the really trailblazing things that he had done to move that forward, they said, "But we reluctantly conclude that too much damage could have been done by the fact that the experiments were done and the fact that he told other jurors, and therefore we remand this for a new trial," which is what happened. It was retried. And so it was like 2 or 3 years after that before finally in Ashland, Kentucky, under another judge, that a jury came back and said aluminum wiring was indeed the cause of the Beverly Hills fire.
And that created a settlement then that Stanley could use?
The settlements were ongoing. Really, defense attorneys would say to this day that the plaintiffs, led by Chesley, but there were others, by the way. Lou Gilligan of Keating, Muthing, and Kleekamp, fine lawyer. Tom Sprawl, who was a very good lawyer, a former Cincinnati City Councilman, was on the team. William Bertelsmann, who later became a federal judge in Covington. That's a lifetime appointment, and he still has senior status, I think, is still probably hearing cases over there. But he was part of that. So there was a team. But there were so many, there were like 100 aluminum wiring manufacturers named as defendants, okay? And so once past the Union Light, Heat, and Power part of it, he was always negotiating settlements to build the fund. And I think by the time of that Ashland, Kentucky verdict, I think there was only one defendant left. Everybody else had settled. And ultimately, that resulted in a fund north of $50 million. I think maybe $53 million was the final number.
We've had another man that we spoke to who had been in the basement and just this spaghetti maze of wiring all over the place. And in fact, in an Enquirer picture that ran in the paper, later in 77, there was a light bulb in a socket hung from the ceiling, suspended there by a coat hanger. So it really was a mess.
I think that was the picture that ran on the, I think on the front page. There was another day that I had one of my highlight reel for my journalism career, and that was when the state police report was coming out. So the governor, Julian Carroll, had convened, after the fire, he had convened this big report, and it was about 6 months. I think it was September when it was coming out, and it was going to come out on a Sunday afternoon. They were going to have a press conference, about the worst time that could happen for a Sunday newspaper, you know, or a seven-day newspaper, really, because as big as the Sunday newspaper was, the Monday newspaper didn't have near the readership. So I said, well, how can we get an advanced look at this report? So it was one of the times when the Jim Schottelkite, the managing editor, said, this is a great story. We were going to run it. We ran the picture you're talking about under the headline, Electrician's Nightmare, which is a quote from that report, which I looked at just the other day. He said, you got to tell me your source because this is, you know, and I said, okay, I'll tell you my source. And it surprised him because it wasn't who he thought it was. But anyway, that was a big story that we ran that Sunday because the anticipation of people who were watching this case was, you know, so many things had been written about what was found in the debris, about inspections that weren't there, that postings that weren't there. And so the release of that report, the best thing I had was that picture and the phrase electrician's nightmare, which was what we built the story around. But to this day, that state police report, it just shows how sloppy the safety measures, if you want to call them that, were handled at that.
Did it also address all the expansions and how
it did
when
it
they
did.
Expanded, they might block an exit here to
Absolutely.
Put on another room
yes.
over here. And the,
right.
And the expansions weren't done by code or to expect inspection and not enough exits for the capacity that they were building it for.
Right. Absolutely. And of course, the other thing that I wanted to mention was that everyone thought that after that, because the governor had predicted indictments, everybody said that the code violations, building code, fire code, were rampant. No posting of the occupancy load. I think the report says it was easy to ignore the occupancy limits because they didn't post them. Nobody knew what they were. And everybody who looked at it after the fact at the state level, okay, said, well, obviously there have been violations of law. The report was then given to the Commonwealth Attorney in Campbell County. He convened a special grand jury, which then took another 6 to 8 months to look at criminal charges, okay? And bear in mind that they could have filed misdemeanor charges of building code violations, fire code violations. They could have done that the next day. But they led it up to this grand jury. Obviously, a grand jury is secret, so nobody knows what the testimony was. And at the end, they reported no indictments. And in fact, Kentucky had a one-year statute of limitations on misdemeanors. And that statute of limitations on all of the misdemeanors, all of the code violations, was let to run during the course of the grand jury. So a lot of people thought, well, justice was done in the civil litigation, or justice would be done in the civil litigation. And this could have been anybody. I mean, it could have been, you know, it could have been inspectors in Southgate, Kentucky. It could have been the state fire marshal in Kentucky. You know, the insurance commissioners. There were lots of places where some responsibility could have been placed. And I think it would have been more satisfactory to the public, even if there would have been an open hearing, an open kind of inquiry, even then if no charges came. But the fact that it was done using the grand jury system meant that, you know, nobody was ever held accountable for that, including the Schillings, you know. And I read in one of the previous anniversary reports, one of the, I think the youngest member of the Schillings said, you know, we had to live with this the rest of our lives and we didn't do anything wrong. Well, that's a leap. You know, that's a leap. I mean, it's true that they weren't charged with anything criminally. They did settle civilly. And it's well and good to say that aluminum wiring caused the fire, but you have to remember that aluminum wiring should have been in there anyway. In complete understatement, a story I found in the New York Times after the Campbell County grand jury returned no indictments had the headline, Report in Club Fire, a Surprise to Many.
I mean, because people think, well, you know, there's Stan Chesley, there's this big trial after the fire, but they forget that was civil. Criminally,
right.
No finger was pointed, no official charge. Nothing.
And I think that, you know, in terms of accountability as a citizen, you expect something of government. Where was the oversight of government? And why was there no oversight? Does that mean that there were bribes? Not necessarily. I think it was, you know, I think it may have been just everybody thought the Schilling, you know, the Schilling, this was a nice thing that everybody loved. And, oh, they were nice people. But really, the oversight, I think, should have been better. And I think that many people would agree with me.
So when you go to clubs today or restaurants or whatever, if it's crowded, do you feel uncomfortable? Do you look for exits?
I don't feel uncomfortable, but I look. I do look. I think that, you know, that a lot of people do. A lot of people remember that. And I guess how, you know, how quickly it happened also is what people remember. It's just, you know, people were there enjoying a warm summer night in minutes, really. In minutes, there were hundreds of people dead.
We had the Southgate fire chief in, and he made the point, you know, that there's a Coconut Grove fire, 40s, and then there's Beverly Hills. But just last year in Oakland, all the people that were living in that warehouse, and, you know, the steps were pallets built up. I mean, just, again, a fire trap that history has proved that we didn't learn a lesson from the Beverly Hills.
And it's interesting when you look back at Coconut Grove, which is, I think, in Boston, you know, the owner went to jail on what started out as a building code violation. I'm not saying that's what should have happened here. I'm saying it just seemed like that possibility was sort of dismissed, you know, very easily in some cases. You know, and of course, the history of Campbell County, of its connections to organized crime and to gambling and all that, which was not true. People really thought that they wanted to bulldoze the place because there was gambling in there. There wasn't any gambling in there. And that doesn't mean that there hadn't been in its earlier iteration. But at the time of this was a very successful club. And they had big name entertainment, obviously. And Greater Cincinnati loved it.
Yeah, Lou Rawls, Sammy Davis Jr., Shirley McClay. Right. I mean, just if you were a big name coming here to this area to play, that's where you played.
Absolutely.
Jim, thank you very much.
You're welcome.